Hey, everyone. Stephanie is wearing white Dance Go clogs today, which means it's 1984, which means the world is upside down, which means Liel might be swearing again, which means you need an obscenity warning. And this is it. Enjoy the show. All right.
Hallelujah.
Bring in Herr Dr. Senator.
No. Wrong vibes, guys. Oh,
yeah. Happy Lagba Omer, the craziest of Jewish holidays. This is Unorthodox, the world's leading Jewish podcast, at least on iTunes, which the Jews control. I am your host, Mark Oppenheimer, joined this week by Deputy Editor Stephanie Butnick.
Hello.
And by Senior Writer Liel Leibowitz.
Ahalan wasa halan.
This is not just middle of the Omer time. This is not just our 130-somethingth show. This is the week that our Jew of the week is Mr. Jew himself, Mr. Jewish Senator himself.
The Mr. Clean of the Jewish
That's
people.
That's right.
The Jolly
Say
Green Giant
tell
of
us,
the
tell
Senate.
Tell us who it is.
Joe Lieberman, who will be in the studio talking about the Omer with us. This is the moment, by the way, where I should say,
I feel like we should play Back in Black by AC/DC when he comes in, like, dan, da da dan.
Wouldn't it be hilarious if he walks in like, you know, a basketball uniform, high top sneaks, and
a Metallica t-shirt.
Yeah.
And like, he's, yo, sup? Oppenheimer, Budnick, Leibowitz.
I like that it's like, it's Log Omer. Who should we talk to? Senator Joe Lieberman, who has just written a book about the Omer.
The Omer, that's right.
And we do not let you guys down.
No.
Not for a second.
This is the leading book on the Omer by a former Democratic, then unaffiliated senator this year, mm-hmm. I would say. For some reason, I also have this image of him walking in vaping. I just think the
like dueling that the teens are doing.
Exactly.
That's his Omer pastime.
I don't want you to be disappointed, but I have a feeling he's not going to be vaping.
Not going to be vaping. That'd be amazing. It was like his post Senate life was that he's like a spokesman for the vape industry.
He sits by the pool, vapes and counts the Omer.
What if it's like a different vape for each day?
Yeah.
Like an Omer. Do they do like Omer advent calendars?
Oh my God, that would be so amazing.
I mean,
vape for every day of the Omer.
The 49 vape pack?
Yeah.
That would be astonishing.
It's exciting for someone who has no idea what Lagba Omer is.
Right. So
for this
I was going to say, not just one, possibly two and a half of us, but millions of Jews in the world have no idea what the Omer is. It's the 49, right? Days from Passover to
50.
Shavuot.
Mm-hmm.
Is it 50?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it's inclusive, right? Right. It's the 50 days from Passover.
We are nothing if not inclusive.
To Shavuot. And if you're being very observant, then at home during those days, you always say a prayer that marks this is the 33rd day of the Omer. This is the 34th day of the Omer. And it is testament to the harvest offering they used to give at the temple before the temple was destroyed in the year 70. So it's a continuation of honoring the harvest
it's
gods.
Actually, kind of amazing. I mean, because, yeah, you did that. And then there was no more temple. So you'd ask, why are you doing this thing that actually doesn't make any sense in the context of Judaism? But the explanation is, and I think the reason why it became this great mystical tradition that I personally enjoy, you know, tremendously.
You are an Omer counter.
I'm an Omer mother-flipping counter, man.
That's right.
Count every day. But here's the logic. And, you know, I think having 17 kids, you will understand.
The snoop refrain, count every day, it is about the Omer.
Mark's going to have one kid for every day of the Omer.
Yeah, since you have 50 children, you would understand, I think, the logic. It's very much like, you know, how kids count down to their birthdays. Like, it's only in 63 days that my birth. It's this logic. Like, you get so excited. And then the Torah comes.
That's right.
And it's like, oh, wow, I'm so special.
Wow, Ten Commandments, lots of rules.
Yeah.
I have to say, like, I'm surprised this hasn't taken off more, because it's like you have Whole 30, you have all these like sort of like wellness trends that count a lot of days, and so we could do like whole mare,
the Omer
30, like
cleanse?
Omer cleanse, yeah.
Omer cleanse.
I think you just made $1 billion.
I think we're too late.
It's the Whole 30 count, no. The Omer no carb,
but we can
diet.
Have Series A financing by next year at this time.
I think this is a good idea.
Count it up, count it up, count it up, count it, count it up, count it up, count it up, count it, count it up, count it up, count it up, count it.
Our Gentile of the Week is Skylar Inman, who is the host of a new podcast about in which she's solving the Palestinian, the Israeli-Palestinian crisis.
You should have just said our Gentile of the Week is Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan.
That's right.
Who's dead, but still.
Whatever.
Come on.
What is up, Jews? Anything on the home front that we should hear about? Well, so Liel, what's up at your home front is you are Omer counting.
I am counting every day.
Do Hudson and Lily, are they into the Omer?
They love the Omer.
It's like perfect for kids, actually.
It totally is.
Seems like.
And Lagba Omer was last night. If you're hearing this on Thursday, Lagba Omer.
If you're hearing this on Thursday, you're still hungover.
From last night.
From Lagba Omer.
Lagba Omer, which is a big.
You're hungomer.
You were hungomer. You've been logging it like there's no tomorrow. So in Israel, this is the great. I mean,
it's a lot
I know,
of campfires, right?
I know I talked about Yom HaTzmaut. I know I hyped it up.
Yeah,
I know
you can
I talked
hype about, all of these Jewish holidays.
But listen to me. Here's the amazing thing. Because you start fires. And here's the thing this will shock you about Israel. Adults let their children start fires
all the time.
Freely in Israel. Like when I was in second grade, we were unsupervised by the campfire.
And
right?
Here you are now.
And the thing is, to start the fire, you need wood. To obtain the wood, you break into construction sites and steal it. But here's the other incredible thing. There's a tradition of burning people in effigy in Israel on Lag BaOmer because it's like a super tribal holiday.
Right. So who do you burn?
Society.
Does it change each year, like depending on geopolitics?
Hitler is the classic. Ugh, like you can't
so
go wrong.
I mean, never gets old.
Hitler is like turkey on Thanksgiving. Like you know, you got
to
do it.
Is it cool to find like a very niche person?
A very niche
like,
person.
A niche terrorist, like the terrorist who was in the news a couple years ago.
And is it only terrorist? What about like
like Bill Cosby? Like today we're doing and Me Too. Like, Effigy.
Harvey Weinstein, Bill Cosby.
That'd be great.
So you're Omering Shay Leibowitz.
Love Omer. Can you translate it for us?
The 33rd day of the Omer.
Okay.
Obviously.
What's up at Butnik Cohen Central in the village?
Central is good. Central actually works because there's only one room in our house. So it actually is very centralized. I guess I started making my own matcha. I am a new person. I was inspired by our producer's son, who's 13 and does it. So I was like, if he can do it, I can.
Yep.
So I got me some matcha.
Do you have one of those like little
Yeah,
fancy...
Because there's this just amazing little grocery store near me. So I went to it and I was like, let me get the matcha. Let me get the like the little whisk.
This is a kind of tea. It's like infused.
It's green tea like on steroids, basically. Okay. It's like a really like a paste almost.
I don't want any part of that.
And then I make a matcha latte. I got coconut milk in there. And then so I was making smoothies also. Like I don't, I messaged Lily Diamond, who is the blogger Kale and Caramel, who was on our show back in November. And I was like, what do I put in my smoothie? And she just like gave me a smoothie life hack. Like this, I have a smoothie right here. It's like spinach, hemp seeds, some vanilla, blueberries, almond butter.
That
I don't know.
Very nutritious. My kids would. That's not
it tastes
a smoothie.
Like, no, it tastes like ice cream.
I have nothing to compete with any of that, except I was at the National Yiddish Book Center for the first time ever.
What's it like?
On Sunday night. It's
amazing.
Gorgeous.
Yeah. Is it as magical as I imagine?
It's totally magical. It's beautiful. It's in Amherst, Massachusetts, basically on the campus of Hampshire College, like a stone's throw from the Eric Carle Museum. It's worth a trip. All right, a little News of the Jews this week. Liel, what do you got for us? What has piqued your interest in News of the Jews?
You know how much I love Roseanne, right?
Yeah, I didn't, actually.
You,
know
that, you loved her before the remake.
You know
the
that reboot. My love for Roseanne is true and real and eternal. And
confusing,
and
yes.
I think she could do That's no wrong.
Bizarre.
Not only an amazing, genius comic of much stature, but also in
actually a very little stature, but okay.
How dare you? But also in recent years, really one of the staunchest defenders of Israel. Israel on the internet.
And perhaps staunchest and unlikeliest.
And unlikeliest.
Unclear if she's doing them any favors, but
people.
Okay.
And so this Sunday, Roseanne spoke at a conference in which she said she will consider as her next act, after returning the ever-popular sitcom to great new heights with a new season of Roseanne, she will consider becoming the, drumroll,
Prime Minister of Israel.
Prime Minister of the State of Israel.
Oh, she'll consider. She'll deign to offer to make Aliyah.
Mark, there is genius in this idea. Here's why.
Okay.
So in America, we elected a reality show star.
Yeah.
Now, Israel has to outdo everyone, right?
So are also going to elect.
No. 80s sitcom star.
80s sitcom.
Look, I got my dad shows on. I'm ready.
Such an improvement on the theme. Imagine the Roseanne Barr cabinet, like the all 80s sitcom themed Roseanne Barr cabinet. So first of all, right, Alex P. Keaton, Minister of Defense. Right? Michael J. Fox from Family Ties. Yeah. That's an absolute given.
Mallory is Minister of Culture. Mallory Keaton.
I think the Keatons could hold like half of the position. Now, I think the army should be commanded by Captain Steubing from The Love Boat.
Can the Knesset physician be Doogie Howser?
The Knesset physician / Minister of Health, Doogie Howser. Now, I think Kirk Cameron should convert to Orthodox Judaism.
He will join Shas.
And become a Shasnik and be Minister of Religion.
We
have a really strong thing growing.
Yep. So that is a fabulous bit of News of the Jews. And Stephanie has a really good one coming up in a second. But I'm just going to read this very short New York Magazine piece with the headline, "Trump Humiliated Michael Cohen at His Son's Bar Mitzvah." This is by Jonathan Chait.
I don't even think you need to go further.
I don't even
need
to go further, right?
I mean, that's right? It.
Donald Trump's ability to weather the Mueller investigation hinges in large part on whether Trump's fixer, Michael Cohen, will flip on him. And that question, in turn, hinges on the bizarre relationship between Trump and the sycophant he often spurns. Cohen alternately worships Trump and resents him, and Trump alternates between rewarding Cohen for his canine loyalty and humiliating him for sport. The Wall Street Journal has a sad example of one of the ways in which Trump has previously embarrassed his fixer. Trump agreed to attend Cohen's son's bar mitzvah, then showed up late, and Cohen humiliatingly delayed the ceremony to suit his boss's arrival. After Mr. Trump arrived, the Journal reports, he gave a speech telling guests he hadn't planned to come, but he relented after Mr. Cohen had repeatedly called him, his secretary, and his children begging him to appear, the attendee said.
So this is the saddest thing in the entire world.
I mean, it's so sad in so many ways. First of all, what a perversion of, I mean, so that's what the bar mitzvah is. The bar mitzvah is, it's not actually about learning any Torah. It's not about leading part of the service. It's not about doing a project of chesed. It's about having a party that Donald Trump shows up at, right? Then you delay the thing for 3 hours because Trump is, of course, late because he's busy Stormying Daniels. And then he shows up and he abuses dad in front of, so basically, here's the irony, right? Here's what it is to be a man, son. You grow up to basically put your manhood in check to a boss who abuses you in front of your children.
Okay, this reminds me of that episode of Entourage where it's Ari Gold's daughter's bat mitzvah and he's like, Vinny Chase, you gotta come, you gotta come, like, it's gonna be the best thing. And then there's like some rival guy there he's trying to make a deal with, and like Vincent Chase is late, and there's just like this amazing scene that plays out. And that was sort of the first time we saw the bar mitzvah as like a transactional thing.
Mm-hmm. Hey Jeremy Cohen, what was the theme of your bar mitzvah? Collusion.
It just makes me sad.
I just love that Trump gave a speech. You know, as they say in Parshat Lech Lecha,
go over there.
I went some of the greatest goings ever. A lot of people are saying.
This was back in 2012, by the way. So we should say that it's old news.
I would pay a lot of money to hear Trump interpret the Bible.
Like a Dvar Torah, yeah, from Trump.
A Trump Dvar Torah,
and like,
would
what
be
was
amazing.
His, like, service project.
Service project is keeping his dad out of jail. But Stephanie, I think you have the best bit of news of the Jews of the week.
This is my favorite story possibly of ever. It's the story of two rabbis, Bess Wollner and Jeremy Simons, who got engaged, were so equally obsessed with Delta Airlines and accruing status on Delta Airlines that they decided to throw themselves a Delta Airlines themed wedding. It had everything. I read about the story this weekend and I decided we had to talk to them. So we actually called them up. Bess Wollner, Jeremy Simons, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. It's great to be here.
Great to have you.
So you guys are basically celebrities.
I mean, it's what everyone dreams of, having their wedding featured in the offbeat news section on all these websites.
Offbeat news section is sort of like where we fall on this show. So when was the wedding?
The wedding was February 18th, so it's a few months ago, but since, as you mentioned, we're both rabbis, the honeymoon is actually not until two more weeks once we're done with our jobs for the season.
Once you're done counting the Omer.
So what is...
Yeah, that's right.
So we've all read about it, but for our listeners who haven't, tell us two things. Number one, where did your Delta obsession come from? I mean, tell us about the obsession. And number two, how do you make a Delta-themed wedding?
First, I'd say with the obsession, when you're a rabbinic student, you, for whatever reason, end up flying a lot of places. Either you have a student pulpit, like I was in, I had one that was local in Southern California in Temecula, but I also had one in Great Falls, Montana, so I had to fly. And then there's also all these opportunities to go to Israel, or with the American Jewish World Service, I went to Thailand, he went to Senegal. So you just start flying all of the time. And, you know, you really have to pick which airline you're going to marry because you want to make the most of it. And so, like, I just took that very seriously. I got the credit card, and then I was like, we're forever, Delta.
Is there, like, a division between, like, an unseen division between, like, airlines and denominations? Like, do Reform rabbis fly Delta, conservative rabbis
yes.
fly American? Is that how that works?
That's a great question. Yeah, I'm going to have to, hopefully, you know, in the comments online or whatnot, people can chime in on this. I have not seen it, but I want to find an answer now.
He's definitely going to spend time researching this now.
Our Facebook group will absolutely have this answer for you in about 3 minutes. We'll have 300 posts. But I will say this, as someone who flew Delta to Israel last year, and I noticed there weren't a lot of super religious people on, I thought, well, the Orthodox are flying El Al. So Delta is, yeah. It was kind of the airline. There were a lot of evangelical Christians going to, you know, doing their Zionist field trip to the Promised Land. And then there were like Reform and conservative Jews. So I do think there is an argument that it's the non-Orthodox rabbis airline to Ben Gurion.
Although, sorry, we're going down kind of a rabbit hole here. You may remember there was a Supreme Court case a few years ago where it was an Orthodox rabbi who had sued at the time Northwest, but became Delta because they had taken away his sky miles.
Oh yeah, so, that was also right up our alley.
That was in Tractate Frequent Flyer in the Talmud. I remember that well.
So yeah, tell us about your wedding.
So you asked how does one go ahead and have a Delta-themed wedding. In our case, it was last summer, so I'm a Hillel director, and I just began this position in Memphis last year. So I was at the Hillel New Directors Institute and talking to some other new directors, making friends, and saying, yeah, I'm getting married in a few months. It's going to be airline-themed, like you do. And David Cohn, who's the Hillel director at Emory, he said, you know who you should talk to? It's my former student, Jason Friedman. He just graduated. He works for Delta Airlines Corporate. He may be able to help you. And Jason made it his mission for the following 6 months or so to make this happen. He was contacting all these other departments within Delta, making sure we had everything we needed. We wanted the things that that you just can't get on the internet, which those things exist. So like if you want 500 Delta cocktail napkins, there's no price you can pay on eBay. They just aren't there. So you really need Delta to be there to do it for you. So napkins, the plastic cups, that sort of stuff.
I assume the wedding started with like a 3-hour delay.
Oh,
no,
right on time.
Too soon.
Delta has the best on-time performance of any American carrier. Shame on you.
Wait, but was there a flight attendant telling you, you know, to buckle in and what to do in case of an emergency if the oxygen masks drop?
There wasn't, but our officiating rabbi Zach Shapiro, he also is an aviation enthusiast. He was with United, but we won't talk about that too much. He's with Delta now, I believe.
He converted. You took him to the mikvah, basically.
Exactly. But we had said to each other, we're like, okay, there's not going to be any Delta in the wedding ceremony. We'll just have it all in the reception. And he used the Torah portion and connected it to Delta beautifully.
Explain how, please?
Yeah.
What was the portion and what was the connection?
So he picked four words, Hebrew words, I would have to go back and look, but that were like come up in the portion, but each of them, like one started with a D and one started with an L and one started with a T and one started with an A.
This
and
is
so
amazing.
Like, and these four words that come up in this Torah portion, it's Delta. And it was like, oh my God, what's happening? But it was perfect.
Here's my question, right? You know, God willing, Hashem gives you a large brood of children. You're settled in the Memphis area. There's probably a little bit less travel in your future if and when that time comes. Do you worry about getting estranged from Delta? Do you worry about losing your diamond status?
Well, first of all, I've never had diamond status, and I don't know if you saw some of the articles, which have some misinformation, but I actually asked him to propose with diamond status. But he respects Delta too much to ask them to do that for someone.
Even you.
By the way, I'm sorry, but I have to ask halachically. So when you do have children, is it like matrilinear descent? Do they inherit automatically the diamond status? Or do they have to?
That would be amazing.
Right?
No, but I guarantee he'll make sure we pay cash for all of our kids starting from birth, even though they're free up till through 2 years old, just so they can accrue miles status.
It's an investment.
So will you tell us what, I know you guys are down in the Memphis area. Will you tell us what you do and where you guys work?
Sure.
So I am the assistant rabbi at Temple Israel in Memphis, Tennessee. It's the Reform congregation here.
And I'm the director of Hillel's of Memphis. We have two campuses, the University of Memphis, and also new this year, we have Rhodes College as well, where we just opened our chapter.
Awesome. They got some Jews at Rhodes College.
And are you guys spreading the gospel of Delta?
Huh.
As they say.
Well, I think that might be a project for the honeymoon. We'll have plenty of time on planes.
Yeah, where are you guys going to go?
So we cashed in a bunch of our Sky Miles.
This is how I knew he loved me. He had never cashed in a mile ever, so he had like 1.5 million miles accrued.
Well, he was waiting and for the so right girl. I mean, there's other girls he flew places with, but he didn't cash in miles for them.
Let's not talk about that. They might be listening.
They definitely are listening. And they are so jealous.
So he did cash them in for the honeymoon. But
so we're very blessed to have about 4 weeks, and we're just going around the world, starting in Europe and working our way eastward.
Rabbis Bess Wollner and Jeremy Simons, it's been a big 2018 for you. First the Delta wedding, then your debut on the number one Jewish themed podcast on iTunes.
Then your honeymoon.
And the honeymoon coming right up.
The honeymoon to come.
I know, dreams come true.
Let me tell you, peaking young in life is, you know, can be a blessing or a curse. You have a lot to do to make 57, 79, live up. So good luck.
So guys, keep climbing.
Keep climbing.
Thank you.
Fly the friendly skies.
I will.
Thanks, guys.
Wow, guys. Our Jewish guest this week is Senator Joe Lieberman. You may remember him as the longtime senator from Connecticut and the 2000 Democratic Party nominee for vice president. He is here now in Argo Studios with us. Welcome, Senator Lieberman.
Good to be here. Thank you.
So your new book is With Liberty and Justice, the 50-Day Journey from Egypt to Sinai, and it touches on the idea of the Omer. So we're happy to have you here during the Omer. But you've also written a book about Shabbat.
Yeah.
And was this sort of the plan all along, like getting to the real Jewish, the Jewish book stuff?
Yeah.
He was playing the long con. He'd like make his name in the whole politics game and then write.
Yeah. Oh, I love that formulation.
Yeah.
It was not the plan all along. I mean, from probably in time in college, as a result of a lot of things, all that, you know, my rabbis and parents taught me about tikkun olam, bettering the world, my own reading of history and the example of President Kennedy, who was really motivating for a lot of people of my generation, my goal, the plan, was to get involved in elective politics. And, you know, I was very lucky because I got to be a state senator, an attorney general, and then U.S. senator for 24 years. And to run for vice president, some people think actually that I was elected vice president, but that's for another day to talk about. So, no, it was not to write. And actually, as I look at it, your question is, because it's somewhat fascinating to me that this is now my second book on Jewish subjects. But as I decided that I was not going to seek a fifth term in the U.S. Senate, that I wanted to go on and have another chapter in my life outside of elective office, that my Jewish observance had become public because I was a public figure, but a lot of it, my davening, my reading, my learning, was not public. And I said, you know what? I'm gonna do a book about Shabbat. And obviously, I'm not a rabbi, so I write as a lay person, which, as I say in the foreword to this book, gives me less authority but more latitude than a rabbi.
I should tell you, by the way, by way of apology,
yes,
this is not the U.S. Senate. We don't listen patiently to what guests are saying. No, we interrupt each other on
really,
this
I just want to tell
podcast.
You how grateful I am. Now, you realize that you're talking to somebody who 5 years ago had the right to filibuster taken away from him when he left the Senate, so he'll have to.
So tell me about this book.
So anyway, I felt so good about the Shabbat book, I wanted to write another one. And Shavuot is something, two things in this book. One is that I've always felt that Shavuot is underappreciated.
It gets the shaft.
It gets the shaft, and it's totally part of Pesach, of Passover.
Right.
I mean, Passover starts the story, the Exodus, the liberation from slavery.
We go from the most appreciated holiday, you're right, in
most
the introduction.
Most appreciated, most
to the
observed.
Least observed.
Yeah.
In 50 days.
So part of it is to say, wait a second, first off, these are connected. I mean, the children of B'nai Israel, children of Israel, were not liberated to wander in the desert or to be equal citizens of Egypt. They were taken out with a mission. They were going to go to the Holy Land, to Eretz Israel, but first to get their national mission statement. I remember learning from my rabbi when I was much younger that the Jewish people really did not become a people until Sinai, because then we got our values, Ten Commandments, Torah, et cetera.
Right.
So my goal here was to do a little marketing for Shavuot and also to make the point of how important law is to the Jewish narrative of life, but also how important the Sinai experience has been to the development of rule of law societies in Western civilization, including America and the rest of the world. So
you talk a little bit in the book, and as you did just here, about the fact that you had over time become a public Jew. Not that anyone ever doubted you were Jewish. I remember when I was in high school and you were taken down Lowell Weicker for your Senate seat, yeah. And nobody didn't think that Lieberman was a Jew.
Right.
I've noticed over the years, on the one hand, obviously you're very publicly Jewish, you talk about it. On the other hand, I always assumed that if you weren't in public life, you would, for example, appear more Jewish, like you'd wear a yarmulke. Were these considerations that when you were running for office, did you think, well, I can't be like a tzitzis and yarmulke Jew because that might be too much for Puritan
Connecticut.
Connecticut.
No. Well, it's a good point. I mean, I'll tell you a little story.
There are more pictures on Google of Barack Obama with a yarmulke than you.
Oh, I have to challenge that.
I'm pretty sure about
that. But here's what I would say. It's generational. In other words, so here's the story. I'm walking in the Capitol with Harry Reid, the former majority leader.
Mormon.
Yeah, Mormon, yeah. Probably 7, 8, 9 years ago. We're going to a meeting. We're talking about the subject of the meeting. I don't even remember what it was. And this was Harry. Suddenly he says, you know, I've been meaning to ask you, Joe, you're an Orthodox Jew. Why don't you wear a skull cap?
I love that he said skull cap.
Yeah, well, but that's literally right.
So joyous.
Not yarmulke, not
right.
Kippah.
Not kippah, skull cap.
Okay. So I said,
because it's with my phylacteries.
What? I keep it clean, please.
Right.
So I said, Harry, you know, it's a good question, and I think it's generational. I grew up in a town, Stamford, Connecticut, where nobody wore a skull cap. Except the rabbi, and the rabbi most of the time was wearing a felt hat. So it was just the way it was. And I wear a kippah in the house all the time, and I wear a kippah when I eat, et cetera, et cetera. But that's the way it was. And I'm not proud of it, Harry. But so Harry said, oh, I know. When he asked the question, he said, look, I see all these young guys around, staff guys around the Capitol wearing skull caps. And I said, you know, that's a new generation. God bless them. They grew up in a different time. And one day, one of them will be in the Senate or the House.
You know what? A similar answer was Jeff Jacoby, the Boston Globe columnist. Mm-hmm. You remember that? Who said, I don't wear one at work because I thought work is a secular place, but I wear one around the house.
No, he puts it on as he leaves the office.
As he leaves the office, he slaps it on.
Interesting.
Speaking of like the word skull cap, something we've talked about on the show now is the way in which the Christian description of faith, so to speak,
right.
Like faith practice. And it's so different than the way we Jews speak about our Jewish observance. And so I'm curious if since you were in public life and since you were in politics, did you feel compelled to speak in a way that was like my Jewish faith practice or like even hearing the Jewish faith to me sounds like something a Jewish person would never say.
Yeah.
So did
interesting.
You...
So tell me more what you mean by the difference between
I guess I'm thinking
the way
of
Christians
someone,
and Jews talk about
someone
faith.
Like Eric Cantor, who very much made his Jewishness palatable to Christians. Like he spoke about it in a way that sort of was in a Christian context.
His faith journey.
Yeah.
Witnessing.
Like, you don't seem like you say like
I don't. I've never felt that. I mean, your question is fascinating to me because I never felt like I had to speak any different than I normally would have spoken. In fact, the way I normally spoke, the way I was educated by my rabbis, by my own learning, seemed to find receptivity among non-Jewish audiences, basic shared beliefs in God, the Bible, et cetera, et cetera.
So I want to ask a thorny question about your journey of faith. So
okay.
it's now Friday after that Tuesday in 2000, after the election.
Yeah.
And you go to synagogue.
Right.
Everything is still very much up in the air. There are lawyer teams getting ready for the battle of the century.
Right.
At any point, do you close your eyes and say, okay, God, listen, I've been very good my entire life. I've never asked you for much. Yeah. I need one big favor. Do me this solid.
Hook a brother up.
Just hook a brother up and make this happen the way we need this to happen.
You know, that's
do you pray for it?
I wish you had been, you know, I had so many speech writers that year. I wish I'd had a prayer writer and it was you. Now, I have to get back into those moments. I'm sure that I prayed for a good outcome, but I don't think I did it on a quid pro quo. Yeah.
No basis. Bracha, no bore priha, hanging chad, nothing like this.
No. Although I'm sure there's a bracha that somehow relates to maybe I should have benched Gomel.
The rabbis
or something.
Can find anything, right?
Yeah.
So can we talk about what things would have been like if you were vice president, an Orthodox Jewish vice president? Like, would there have been a kosher kitchen in the White House? Like, were provisions being made for that kind of stuff? Like, what were Hagim going to look like?
Or in like a state dinner, are you the one just getting like a little like sellotape little turkey sandwich with a hashgacha?
What would it have been like? We didn't work anything out, but it was very clear that the vice presidential residence would have been kosher.
When you were traveling the world in all of your foreign policy work, would you eat non-kosher? There must have been situations where you had to.
So I guess I'd say I'm a truly modern Orthodox Jew in that sense, practically speaking. I mean, I don't eat treif, really. But, you know, in those kinds of circumstances, I eat vegetables or I say I'm a vegetarian. When I can't get kosher food, you'd be amazed at how many places you can get kosher food. So,
you're very diplomatic about it.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's just, to me, it's sort of practical.
You
got
to eat.
You got to eat. I was sitting at a state dinner one time when I went to China. I was sitting next to the foreign minister and I kept getting vegetarian dishes. You know, they have many dishes at a Chinese dinner. So he said to me, Senator, if you don't mind me asking, I notice you're eating vegetarian food. Are you perhaps a Buddhist? So
you like sorta?
I said, no, Minister, I'm Jewish and I'm kosher, but vegetarian suits my purposes.
You're
for
like
tonight.
Jewish and kosher. So on Christmas, what are you?
All right.
So to tie this all together, the book is built as a series of meditations. They're short and they're meant
very
to
Buddhist.
Each very
yes,
Buddhist
very.
To each be read on a different day of the Omer. Today we happen to be sitting here on the eve of the 32nd,
right?
On which the meditation that you wrote is actually kind of interesting. It's about the influence Jewish ideas and tradition have had on the founding fathers. Is this something that you always felt as an Orthodox Jew who spent, you know, all of his life or most of his life in Washington?
Yeah.
Is that a connection that you felt between the faith and the foundation of the Republic?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know when it was born within me or when I had that insight, but studying history, different writers, Michael Novak, who was actually a Roman Catholic theologian, a social commentator, now passed away in the last year or two, but he wrote a book called On the Wings of Eagles. And his basic contention was that the American Revolution, the American nation, the American eagle had two wings which enabled it to fly. One was the one that everybody gives credit to, which was the Enlightenment, you know, the great philosophers, Locke, et cetera. But he said the other was the Hebrew Bible. And he makes a very compelling case about that. That may have crystallized things for me. I talk about it here in this book with Liberty and Justice. In fact, as you know, some may miss it, the title comes from the American Pledge of Allegiance, One Nation Under God with Liberty and Justice for All. And it makes the point about the message of the Torah that essentially liberty alone is not enough. We need the law to achieve justice. So anyway, history does tell us that the Calvinists raised up the Torah, what they call the Old Testament, what we call the Hebrew Bible today. And it was very much in the worldview of the founding generation of Americans. But so it mattered. That mattered to me. It actually was a source of comfort, being raised in a Torah education, to know that the Torah had so affected this country that was giving me all these
that you weren't some weird outsider, but actually had a claim to the foundational narrative.
I think that's right, exactly. And of course, this has become one of the great changes. I'll make one sentence here. We can come back and do another podcast on this. But one of the great transformations that's occurred in my lifetime, which I don't think gets enough credit, is the change in the relationship between Jews and Christians, which began in the Catholic Church with the ecumenical Pope John the 23rd, and has continued on through changes in doctrine, etc., and also, of course, the blossoming of this Christian evangelical movement, which always existed. In some sense, some of our founding fathers were Zionists. You can see it in their writing, but now it's a major American and world force that's been very critical to Israel's strength in the world.
Well, that actually goes into a question I wanted to get to before before you head off to your legal practice.
Okay.
Okay. So here we are. It's 2016.
Right.
Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump. Who'd you vote for?
I voted for Hillary Clinton. I supported her publicly.
Now, I'm guessing a lot of your fellow shulgoers, you walk into a modern Orthodox synagogue, most parts of America, there are going to be a lot of people who are Trump supporters. What are they getting wrong?
Well, part of our Jewish ethic, I think, is to remember that we were once strangers, foreigners, minority group, however you want to interpret the word, in Egypt, and therefore we have an eternal obligation to treat strangers in our own midst, and this certainly includes immigrants, kindly. So where did they get it wrong? I think they got it wrong by focusing too much, and I understand it, on Israel. And they were also troubled, as voters obviously were beyond the Jewish community, that Hillary Clinton was a step back. They were uneasy about President Trump. They knew that they were taking a risk. But I think in the end, a lot of them voted for him because they wanted a change.
When you watch the news now, when you watch CNN, do you think to yourself, my God, I am so happy I am no longer in politics because this is crazy? Or do you think, man, just give me one more shot at the Senate, I would make it all right?
So it's a mixture, really. I mean, part of it is I also, the news, because it's such reality TV, and it's so unprecedented, that is in the subject matter, that I'm drawn to it, and my wife is too, and I have to say to her, sweetheart, really, this is the second or third show tonight we've seen the same material covered on the cable news. Let's turn to Netflix or Amazon.
Yes. Let's count the Omer.
Let's watch Victoria.
Orange is the New Black, a little.
Something like that.
Entourage.
So generally speaking, no. I had 40 years in elective office, long time. Very privileged in this setting, I would say blessed to have had that opportunity. The last 2 years were the least productive because it was getting really partisan, ideologically rigid. I will own up to the fact, without embarrassment, that every now and then something happens that I read, I hear, and I say, I wish I was there. I'd call up McCain or Susan Collins, and I'd say, let's do this about that. At least let's go down to the Senate floor and have a colloquy on it, try to get some.
And now all you can do is text them and be like, Susan, here's what you got to say.
But I must admit, it passes quickly. I'm working on some political advocacy groups.
Is there anyone that you see kind of in the field in 2020 you're really excited about?
Not yet. No, not yet. It's a really good question. I mean, I think that Democrats have a big opportunity, but, you know, they're probably going to be, as somebody said to me, 50 candidates.
Now
there won't be 50, but there'll probably be 20. And it's really important to get somebody who can convince people that they can win.
If it's Elizabeth Warren, whom you've been very critical of, versus Donald Trump, do you stick with the Democrats?
I don't know. Tough call. I mean, that would be my instinct, but she would make it hard. I don't really know her. Interestingly enough, I know Sanders because I served with him.
Would you vote Bernie over Trump?
It depends where we are. That would be an easier call for me as a Democrat, interestingly enough.
Wow.
Bernie's is a genuine article. I disagree with him on a lot of stuff, but he's...
Can you get him here as a Jew of the Week for Unorthodox? Can you hook us
that'll
up?
That'll be harder.
identify as a Jew of the Week.
No, he'd be our poll of the week.
Yeah. I mean, the weird coincidence here is a roommate of mine at Yale who became Chabad Lubavitch is a professor of philosophy and religion, University of Vermont in Burlington, became a great friend of Bernie's. Fascinating. So they have a dialogue that goes on, and His name is Rick Sugarman, and we decided he's probably the only person in America who can say that Bernie and I are his best friends.
Wow. We got to get him on. There we go.
Well, he'd be really interesting.
There we go. Senator Joe Lieberman, author of two books. One of them is The Gift of Rest, Rediscovering the Beauty of the Sabbath. And the new one, fresh for Omer season, yes, co-written with Rabbi Ari Kahn, with Liberty and Justice, The 50-Day Journey from Egypt to Sinai. Also a partner at Kasowitz, Goldberg, Blumberg, Steinberg, and Oppenheimer.
Oh, no. Kasowitz, Benson, and Torres.
Oh.
When I met Hector Torres, I said, thank God. So he said, I'm Sephardic. But he was joking.
Oh, he was joking.
He's a Puerto Rican-American from the Bronx and also went to Yale Institute.
Well, thank you for being our Jew of the Week.
Thank you.
A pleasure.
It's an honor.
Blue dog, with me in my big boy bed, a patch of denim on your head. We've been through our ups and downs. Blue dog, mommy wants to.
Unorthodox has been growing by leaps and bounds, and one of those moves has been to go international. You know, we have a strong following in Israel, Canada, Australia, England, you know, places where there are a lot of Jews.
Oman, Qatar,
Senegal. That's right, Namibia. But we're looking to make the move into places that maybe historically have been less Jew-friendly, where the Jewish population has shrunk over the years, as we shall say. So
what you're saying is that we need some Lebensraum,
yeah,
for Unorthodox,
yeah,
some,
yeah,
Anschluss of some, yeah, other territories.
Exactly.
So where do we go this week?
This week we went off Deutschland to Germany. And Liel, explain a little bit about what took Unorthodox to Germany this,
jawohl,
week.
Jawohl, Herr Kommandant. And so in Germany, two famous rappers have won a prestigious popular music award for lyrics that, shall we say, are somewhat objectionable. Shall we say objectionable because they make fun of Auschwitz survivors. And so Stephanie and I talked to the premier expert on German hip-hop, Tobias Verlenski, a name which Stephanie and I butchered mercilessly.
Accidentally.
Ish. And so what I love about this interview you're about to hear is, first of all, really getting an amazing insight into German racist hip-hop, which is its own category, but also the fact that all the jokes that Stephanie and I made, Tobias Verlenski really didn't laugh at any of them.
He's not allowed to laugh at any of
them. He was like, that is a funny joke,
actually,
but I cannot laugh at any of it.
It actually illuminated the entire thing so much more for me, the story, when actually speaking to a German person who's like, you can't say any of this stuff. So it highlights how actually truly offensive those lyrics are in Germany.
This may explain why we actually have so few listeners in Germany.
That's
because,
right,
basically,
they're like, stop joking,
like,
about this.
But these people sent me Auschwitz. I will not listen to them.
Right. So to listen to us in Germany would be to microaggress against all of the,
yeah,
victims of your great-grandfather,
oh,
in,
Lord,
his SS uniform. So, all right, let's roll tape.
Yeah, the headline in the New York Times says, Fury in Germany as rap duo with anti-Jewish lyrics gets award. I have no idea what that means. Could you, like, break it down for us what's going on over there?
Okay, so the album already released, like, a month ago, and a lot of people were already kind of disgusted by the lyrics, but the real fury, as the New York Times would say, started when the duo Kollega and Farid Bang received an award for the album as the best hip-hop album. But we have to say that the award isn't like a critical award. It's mostly just about sales. Like, if you are successful, if you sell a lot, then you will receive the prize. And there is a jury, but nobody really knows how much influence the jury has. So
hold on, tell us before we even go any further, this duo, like, to American listeners who may not be very familiar with German hip-hop, these guys are like the what? Are they like the Nelly, the Flo Rida of America, the what?
They are not so much like pop as Nelly or Flo Rida, but they started as like gangster rappers. And already before they were ripping about like pretty much the cliche gangster rap thing about cars, about big muscles. They trained a lot. Like Kollega, if you look at pictures 10 years ago, he wasn't that muscular. So they were training a lot, they were practicing, and he even sold which is called the boss transformation, so people can actually become like him and just buy a kind of a protein shake, everything.
So he's
and
like a fitness guru.
Yeah, exactly. It's like that. It's like pretty weird.
So was this just intended to provoke? I mean, could you tell us what the lines were that really sparked this controversy?
I mean, the line that everybody is talking about is, I just quoted from the New York Times article because I think they translated it. They, Farid Bang is rapping that his body is more defined than Auschwitz prisoners.
Who did not, for historical accuracy sense, did not have access in Auschwitz to his protein powders. It would have changed everything if they did.
Oh, wow. That's very sarcastic. I cannot laugh about this because I think it's... Yeah, you have to understand, as a German, it's already hard to talk about stuff like this. And to joke, it's pretty
okay
odd.
To laugh, Tobias.
Okay, thank you very much.
So I have a kind of a difficult and maybe a little bit of an unfair question. Do you think do you think these guys are popular because they say things that sound like controversial and like dangerous and cool? Or are people really attracted genuinely to some sort of nefarious political message here? In other words, is this for real or is this just a pose?
Well, that's difficult. I cannot really answer that question, but definitely people are attracted to people that are provoking. I mean, especially in music, especially in rap, that's like a formula that worked. Also, and that's a really big problem, is a lot of anti-media right now. And this is something you might be familiar, Trump and a lot of right-wing parties are kind of against the establishment, against what is already there and what might control us. So Kollegah is really getting on the highest levels in talking about, hey, I'm going to offer journalist €25,000 if you cover Pizzagate in a real way. And a ton or most of his listeners might not even know what Pizzagate was about.
It sounds so much better when you say it. When you sound, it's just Pizzagate.
Yeah. Give it some continental verb.
Yeah, here it's pizza.
I have to tell you though, here I think in the United States, part of the glory is that just say whatever the fuck you want, and no one really gets that worked up in these ways because there are no laws making any kind of, you know, real restrictions. I mean, I understand the historical sensitivities, but I wonder to what extent they actually help build people like Kollegah up, because now he genuinely seems like he's counter, you know, anti-establishment dude. When he's just a, you know, gangster rapper wannabe.
Yeah, I mean, the whole discussion definitely benefits them in a way. He can say, hey, I'm the good guy and all the media is now against me, so buy my album kind of stuff. I don't know. They provoked and they even got into the New York Times, so they can be happy in a way, but it's a dangerous thing to get like a ton of teens against the media, not trusting anyone, and that's pretty much what they are doing, and I don't know.
So Tobias, you're a podcaster, you're an editor, you work at the German version of Genius, formerly known as Rap Genius. Like, you know what's going on? Like, you know, tell us about the rap scene in Germany.
It's like a huge scene. It's very, very diverse. I mean, it's pretty hard to talk about that, but definitely
tell us one artist you're really excited about today. So we could go out with them instead of listening to Kollegah and, you know, the other dude.
I'm a big fan of Megalo. He made an album also with two other artists, Ganyan Stallion and Musa. And I covered the album of them. It's called Platz an der Sonne. And it talks about Africa and a lot of stuff. And is more like, talking about self... I don't know the exact translation, but the album was really talking about politics and still good music. So Exact opposite of Kollega, I can really recommend you to listen to Megalo.
Amazing. Man, thank you so, so, so much.
Thanks, Tobias.
Thank you.
My name is Megalo, M-E-G-A-L-O-H-A. Ich bin die Rap-Entität aus M-O-A.
That was Leah Leibowitz and Stephanie Butnick speaking with German hip-hop expert Tobias
Velinsky.
Doppel-S-E-N,
Moment. M-E-G-A, Peng Peng, P-P-K, Style auf Bestellung. Hör kurz mal rein, auf die Schnellung, wie 9 mm Parabellum.
Our Gentile of the Week is Skylar Inman. She's the host of Intractable, a podcast that collects narratives and stories about those living in Israel and Palestine. She was born and raised in Houston, Texas, and graduated from Yale last May. Skylar, welcome to the program.
Thanks, guys. It's great to be here.
What this is just a Jewish podcast that even our Gentile of the Week lives in Israel.
Yeah, like, and what did a nice Gentile like you end up? How did you end up doing a podcast about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? How'd you get to Israel? Like, what's going on?
It's like I could go work for McKinsey, or I could go to try to solve the world's most intractable dilemma.
Yeah, I guess I can only describe it as the Jewish agenda of Yale University, I guess. No, it's not such a long story, actually. I ended up going on this trip that was just supposed to bring interested young American students who wanted to know more about the conflict. It's called the Peace and Dialogue Leadership Initiative, or PDLI for short. Yaleys love to make things with long acronyms. And I had like an 11-day sort of breakneck tour of Israel, and I left feeling like the most profound sense of spiritual, physical, and mental jet lag that I've ever felt. And I knew I needed to come back. I had been interested in conflict situations for a really long time. And as Mark knows, I studied storytelling in various aspects in college. And I sort of just thought, maybe I can combine all of these interests. And I applied for a fellowship from Yale. And somehow they said yes. And I booked a flight to Tel Aviv.
All right, so now you're in Tel Aviv, and it's no longer the tour. It's no longer it's real life. You live here. What are some of the things that struck you as like, oh my God, these people are so freaking weird? Like, what are some of the things that you still have a hard time adjusting to?
As far as Israeli culture goes?
As far as life in Israel.
Well, I guess as an American, I'll never totally get used to the brutal honesty, and also the fact that lines just don't really seem to exist.
Mazel lines.
Yeah, exactly. As far as the life on the Israeli side goes, I've really learned how to like elbow my way to the front of clusters of people in order to get what I need as quickly as possible. So I think I'm adapting. I think I'm adapting pretty well, actually, to that aspect of it. The one thing that really took me by surprise in Tel Aviv specifically during the summer last year is the absolute ubiquity of the dripping air conditioner units. Like, you'll be walking down the sidewalk and you'll just be like pelted with air conditioning drips. And you have to like, everyone on the sidewalk is kind of doing this like little Tel Aviv tango where you're like sidestepping all of the like dripping, disgusting AC exhaust.
This is very true.
So Skylar, I'm curious, your podcast requires you to get to these sort of emotional places with different people. And I'm wondering if being an American, but being a Christian and not a Jewish American coming into, say, the West Bank and talking to people, do you think that gives you an advantage and allows people to open up to you?
Yeah, I definitely think that there's some aspect to my identity that allows me to, first of all, travel in ways that some people might not feel safe traveling. I mean, you go into the West Bank and there are these big red signs. They don't say you're not allowed to travel here if you're Jewish, but they say if you're Israeli, you know, not only is it against the law, but it's dangerous to your life. And, you know, even though it doesn't say if you're Jewish, it's dangerous to your life, that's certainly how it reads. I mean, get a giant, like, I'm talking like 8-foot tall sign and write that on it, and it's pretty intimidating. So just on a personal level, it's something that's open to me in a way that it might not feel open to other people. But yeah, I guess there is, especially with this topic, there's this feeling that your identity really determines your opinion. And I think coming from this sort of like place that's seen as somewhat wacky, which is Texas, you know, I'm not just a non-Jewish American. I'm an American from the South, which is sort of like the butt of many jokes. And it does open doors. I think when I introduce myself and I explain who I am and where I'm from, people on both sides sort of say, okay, well, maybe she doesn't have a set opinion yet. Maybe she'll actually listen to my story for what it is instead of coming at it from an attack standpoint.
It's astonishing to me that people in Ramallah are making fun of Houston.
No, it's not so much that they make fun of it, but when I say Texas, there's sort of this like universal laughter that follows. They're like, oh, haha, George Bush or cowboys.
That's
like,
hilarious.
Do you call good company good barbecue? We have much better barbecue.
So, I mean, speaking of that, but I mean, doing this dance of kind of moving across spaces and across borders is hard, even for a nice Texan like you. You know, every single word or expression has some sort of, you know, counterpart or controversy. Is it the apartheid fence? Is it the security barrier? Is it Judea,
Absolutely.
Samaria, occupied territories, this, that? Like, have you found a rabbi, so to speak, someone to guide you, a mentor, or do you just Google stuff a lot? How do you decide? Every word of your script for Intractable is a potential.
Is intractable,
right? How have you negotiated that?
And maybe truly.
Any particular thorny story that you want to tell about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's definitely sort of this like meta level of intractability, like you said. Like I at first I was so anxious just even about like parsing my words and, you know, do on an ethical sort of journalistic level, do I change the words that I use when I interview different people or do I sort of stick with like the like I guess what you would call the New York Times / like UN peacekeeper lingo of like the most neutral words possible. And I think for the most part, when I'm doing the research, I try to stick to the most widely accepted journalistic terms. And then, you know, sometimes I'll encounter someone who really does bristle at the use of a certain word. Like, for example, in episode 3, I interview the director of a theater in Jenin. And my first question of that interview was, so what has your experience been living your whole life? You know, you were born during the conflict, you lived through the Second Intifada, and now you're living life with sort of the post-Second Intifada on this one side of this wall. Can you tell me about what life is like in conflict for you? And he said, well, first of all, it's not a conflict, it's an occupation. And so like that was like right off the bat, I felt like maybe, you know, I was on the wrong foot, maybe he wouldn't trust me now. But I asked him, so, you know, what's the difference between a conflict and an occupation? And I sort of got him talking on that. And his answer was, to me, when people say conflict, it sounds like you're saying we each have equal power in this situation. And for me, living on this side of the wall, where, you know, on any given night, your home can be raided and you don't necessarily know why. It feels much more like something that's imposed from above. Hmm. And I think that there, when you get people really talking about why they use the words that they use, you generally tend to reach some sort of emotional truth that transcends the dictionary definitions of the words, if that makes sense.
So we always allow our Gentile of the Week to conclude with a question for us. Is there anything that this internationally recognized panel of Jewish experts can tell you?
Oh, yes. I've been wondering for a very long time. It's sort of a podcaster to podcaster question.
Okay.
P2P.
You end every episode saying that you have rabbinical supervision. And I'm just wondering, first of all, what does that mean? How do you talk to these rabbis? Do you email? Do you Skype them in? Do they sit in the studio? What do they approve? And do I need rabbinical supervision?
Well, they send money, you see.
It's advertising.
We sell absolution. We got the model from our younger brothers.
So I'll take those. I'll go backwards. First of all, absolutely you need rabbinical supervision. We all do. But the answer to your question, and this is, I feel naked before your question, is that it's just a joke. it's sometimes no. like sometimes
Although
it's a shout out.
It's not really a joke.
It's a genuine. It's humorous, but it's a genuine appreciation of people who don't get enough love. You know,
and
people who
we
have
don't
pulpits.
Ask them for anything. Actually, that's, right. that's the answer. Like, we don't ask them to do anything. We assume that all rabbis are so overworked. They're ministering to their congregations. They're doing all
they're
this stuff. They're fellowshipping
with the Jews.
With the Jews.
They're
working
on
their faith practice.
Journey, yeah.
But it's just like a nice way to shout out different people. And the best thing is that as we started doing it, people write in and tell us like, oh, shout out my rabbi or shout out this rabbi who's doing something really cool. And so this is your question is a great opportunity for us to tell people that they can nominate their rabbi.
We love rabbis.
Absolutely. So a lot of it is nominations. And then sometimes early in the show, like the first year when we weren't getting nominations, sometimes I would just think like, let's pick up some listeners in Montpelier, Vermont. And I would Google like conservative synagogue or reform temple, Montpelier, and find a rap. And then I'd find like the assistant cantor. And, you know, I would just find someone who just is.
That is amazing.
Somebody you know doesn't get enough love. And that would be the rabbinic supervision.
It's sort of like retweets do not equal endorsement. Rabbinic right? supervision does not equal endorsement. But please hold them responsible for everything we say this
That's
episode.
Right. Is that exciting for you?
That's
is that a
beautiful.
Huge letdown, Skylar?
I don't know. In a way, it's like I've just discovered that this
like
mythical
Santa?
Creature is not real, yeah. but in another way, it's giving me some ideas for my own podcast, I guess.
So speaking of your podcast, the podcast is Intractable, in which Skylar Inman travels around Israel and the West Bank conducting interviews, trying to get to the bottom of this, trying to explain to all of us who kind of know there's a conflict, but maybe don't know the ins and outs, what exactly the conflict or the occupation or the rebellion, whatever you want to call it, is. Her work is at intractablepodcast.com and on iTunes, and it's written in skywriting above Manhattan.
Skylar, I feel like if anyone can do this, it's you.
Yeah.
No pressure.
Thanks, guys. I'll keep listening to you guys as yeah. well. Yeah.
Donald Trump needs you. Thanks, Skylar.
Thanks, guys.
Maybe I'm intractable. And maybe you wish you knew what that means. And maybe I'm just too political. And maybe you are just dreaming of me.
Hey, J.Crew, you know something you can do for us besides listening and telling all your friends to listen? You can rate us on iTunes. Here's a really great review we just got. It's from Nell Minow. I feel like Goldilocks. I've been looking for a podcast on Jewish topics that was not too reverent, not too secular, but just right. And here it is, a lively conversation on the issues of the day and the issues of the millennia. Bugs in Roman artichokes? Who knew? I like the different perspectives of the three hosts, and they always have fascinating Jewish and non-Jewish guests. The topics range from the most theological and liturgical to the most secular and contemporary, and I very much appreciate the engagement on Facebook as well. Mazel Tov and Todah Rabah, 5 stars, Nell Minow. Now,
En badma, Baruch Hashem, Mazal Tov.
Be'ezrat Hashem,
Siman Tov, Mazal Tov.
That's right. Aleinu l'shabeach. Rating us on iTunes does push us higher up and gets us in front of more people.
And it validates us.
Yeah. We have very low
Most
self-esteem.
Importantly.
Really, whatever you could do to help us.
We could show our love to our spouses and children. Say, see, somebody loves us. Also, a bunch of chances to hang with us and ours. For those of you looking to get into the Shavuot frame of mind, unorthodox guest and Tablet contributor Jenna Weissman-Joselit, the great historian, will be discussing her book Set in Stone, America's Embrace of the Ten Commandments. She'll be at New York's Congregation Rodef Sholom on the Upper West Side at 7 p.m. on Monday, May 14th. Go to rodefsholom.org/tablet to get your tickets. If that's not enough, you can come see us live. I will be at Greenwich Reform Synagogue on Friday, May 18th. Stephanie will be moderating the next installment of the Jewish Book Council's Unpacking the Book discussion series at the Jewish Museum. She'll be there on June 14th talking with novelist Rachel Kadish and historian Lisa Moses Leff. On the evening of Shavuot, Leah Leibowitz will be at the 14th Street Y in Manhattan all night long.
All night long.
That's the night of
May
19th.
I'll be singing that song.
He will be doing the Tikkun Liel Shavuot. Tikkun Liel Shavuot, the all night learning. That would actually be, listen, I'm actually going to say something. Those of you who may not be particularly observant but are looking to do something crazy, a
the
great
funnest thing in the world.
Entry point would be
Absolutely.
Studying with Liel all night long on May 19th. That's a great idea.
And there'll be art, there'll be plays, there'll be drinking.
The 14th Street Y.
Cheese.
Mazel Tovs. Liel, might you have a Mazel Tov this week?
You know, sometimes you go to a concert and it's just a concert. And you come home, you forget about it the next day. Yesterday, I saw a concert that kind of left me literally speechless, which is not a...
You recovered by this morning, but your speech came back.
I kind of did, but, but it took a while. Yeah. That's not an easy feat, you know, for me. There's an Israeli artist named Victoria Hanna, which some of you may have seen on YouTube. If you didn't, drop everything and go watch her. She has a fascination with the kind of mystical Kabbalistic power of Hebrew letters and sounds and words, and does this thing which begins, it's almost all liturgical texts put to music, and it almost always starts as just words and then kind of evolves into ritualistic, amazingly weird, amazingly beautiful, trance-like soundscapes.
Like this podcast.
Just like this podcast. Go pour yourself a drink and listen to Victoria Khanna.
How do you spell the last name for people who...
Chet.
Hannah.
C-H-A-N-A.
Got it. Stephanie, mazel tov?
I have a mazel tov from a listener, but I just wanted to say that I found out yesterday that Judith Lieber, the designer of the iconic, crystal-encrusted handbags.
Yeah.
And she died on Saturday at her home in East Hampton, of just hours after her husband, who was himself an artist, the painter and sculptor Gerson Lieber. They died within hours of each other. She was 97. They were married for 72 years. She was just an amazing figure in American and Jewish history.
And a Holocaust survivor.
She met Gus when he was stationed. He was an American soldier. He was stationed in Budapest, and she was living there. And she actually was, before the war, went to London to study cosmetics because that's what she wanted to do.
Right.
And then, of course, she was called back. And as she says, Hitler put me in the handbag business. So in a weird way, we have Hitler to thank for those beautiful purses in the shapes of like dogs and cats and animals.
Judith Lieber.
And she's just,
to thank
yeah.
Too. God bless.
So just
goodbye, Judith Lieber.
And this comes in from super listener Morgan Block. She says, I was using my super styling unorthodox tote bag, as one does, in the Tribeca Whole Foods, when the man handing out cheese samples said to me, I love Tablet Magazine.
See?
I asked if he had listened to Unorthodox. He had not, but was very excited to download it before the next time he heads to the gym. So, if you'll allow me, I'd like to send a mazel tov to Brent the Cheese Guy, purveyor of delicious kosher cheese, fellow friendly New York City Jew, and hopeful new Unorthodox listener. Mazel tov, Brent. Mazel tov, Morgan. Thanks for rocking our tote. You guys are the best. God.
Brent.
Next year in Tribeca.
Morgan Block, Brent the Cheese Guy. Whew. I will not top that. I do have a kind of sub rosa mazel tov. I'm not going to go last name here, but the basic story is we got a phone call about this amazingly beautiful couple who very much connect around an Orthodox, and the man wants to wish Leah a happy birthday. And I want to say that it sounds as if, Leah, it sounds as if you are marrying an amazing man. Apparently, Tinder can lead to true love. And the message that he left on our voicemail moved us all to tears. I also want to give a shout out to our new listener, Elizabeth M. I don't know if she wants her last name revealed, but she is following the podcast and says it's helping in her conversion process, that she's really sort of understanding Jews because of us. That is a lot of pressure. We will try to do right by you.
Like, I get it. They interrupt a lot. Okay.
That's why I have to ask three times, because the rabbi keeps interrupting you.
Unorthodox is brought to you by Tablet Magazine, on the web at tabletmag.com. Write to us at unorthodox@tabletmag.com or leave us a voice message, 914-570-4869. For merchandise, bit.ly/unorthoshirt. Follow Stephanie on Instagram at sbutnik. Follow the show on Instagram at unorthodoxpodcast and on Twitter at unorthodox_pod. Join our Facebook group. Our show is produced by Josh Cross and Shira Tolushkin with help from Julia Frakes. It's edited by Noah Levinson. Our artwork is by Esther Werdiger. Our intern is Theo Cantor. Our theme music is by Golem, online at golemrocks.com. Our mailbox theme is by Steve Barton. Rabbinic supervision this week by Rabbi Stephen Kushner, retiring in June after 38 years at Temple Ner Tamid in Bloomfield, New Jersey. Also, rabbinic supervision, double supervision this week by Rabbi Mike Werbo. A happy belated birthday to him. Email me at moppenheimer@tabletmag.com if you have a rabbi to nominate for supervision. We record at Argo Studios, which is studying for its adult bar mitzvah, to which it will invite Donald Trump. And we're proud to be part of the Panoply Network. Shalom, friends.